комару. Ты душа любезный, совсем не под пару. Ты цветочка кроза родного Кавказа.
Hello and welcome to Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rosanna Novikova.
As you listeners know, the Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and you generous patrons out there who give us monthly contributions to help us keep this show going. And we would really appreciate it if you would become a patron to show us how much you appreciate this show, you value what we do, and you're willing to invest in it. So if you want to help out and become a supporter of the Eurasian Knot, go to patreon.com/Euronaut and become a patron and, you know, become a contributor. So how are you, Rosanna?
I'm doing pretty well. Going to Joshua Tree this weekend.
Oh, really? Nice.
It's very exciting.
Are things blooming there already?
I'm not sure, but it's at least it's not raining over there, and it's sunny, and it's somewhere around like low 70s. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be really nice weather, very pleasant.
That's great. Oh, wow. I'm jealous. Actually, you know, all the years I lived in Los Angeles, I think I've only been to Joshua Tree maybe once or twice. I remember it being incredibly beautiful. You know, this episode is an interview that I hosted at Reese on Nagorno-Karabakh. And listeners who listen regularly will remember that we actually did an interview about Nagorno-Karabakh way back in October. But people at the Russian East European Eurasian Studies Center wanted me to host an additional conversation about the fate of Nagorno-Karabakh and Armenia and Azerbaijan to supplement the interview we did back in October, to give it more attention, because this is a subject that kind of came and went really fast, and it's good to provide another perspective and maybe update, you know, what is going on there.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
But before we get into that, listeners might remember we asked you all to send us some sounds from the region that interest you, that bring up memories, and we actually got our first submission.
Woohoo!
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised because honestly, I don't know what you thought, but I didn't know how well this would kick off, and I was pleasantly surprised to get one a few days ago.
You shouldn't doubt our initiatives, our brilliant initiatives.
Oh, I shouldn't. I see. I should have more confidence. I will definitely keep that in mind for the future. This submission comes from Maria Fedorova, and she says she listens to every episode as soon as it comes out. Can you believe that?
Yeah, she's our ideal listener.
All right. And so here is the sound that she submitted to us. Rusana, do you know this theme?
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell the listeners what it is?
Well, for those of you who don't know, it is an opening of a primetime Soviet news show, Время.
And, you know, we ask listeners when they submit these sounds to tell us why, you know, why this sound as opposed to anything else. And Maria says that she sent this because of conversations she's been having with her students in a class she teaches at McAllister College called A Global History of Time. Right? Vremya means time, so that's quite relevant. But she also added that when she really sits down and think about it, the Vremya theme is a sound from her childhood. And for her, it signals the time to go to bed. And she remembers her parents sitting in the kitchen and watching the nightly news. This is the main news program. And she herself doesn't remember watching Vremya. She was about 3 or 4 years old. But of course, the sound stuck with her. And she adds, and this is a quote, "The program has changed so much since then, yet has not changed at all. It's still the official outlet for state news." So it's
So accurate.
you feel that's an accurate depiction of it?
It struck me as a very accurate description. And so do I. I remember the sound like vaguely from my childhood. And I mean, it doesn't associate in my mind with the news, but I kind of remember it in the background playing at night. So I kind of have similar memories of that.
Yeah, well, I would be surprised if there aren't many more people out there who have a similar memory, not, you know, of watching the news, but the sound of that signifying something. First off, thanks, Maria, for sharing this with us. This is exactly what we're looking for when we envision this idea. So if you listeners out there have a sound that has stuck with you, send it in to us, record it, or send a link like Maria did. She sent us a YouTube link. And you could submit these at yourknot.org/contact. So on our contact page. And we'll play them and let us know why and what it means to you. And we'll have a short chat about it like we did with Maria's Vremya theme song. So
we're very excited to get more submissions.
Definitely. Some listener participation. How about that? So, well, let's go on to, I think, probably not as cheerful subject, and that is Nagorno-Karabakh. And Rusana, why don't you introduce our guests?
Kelsey Rice is an assistant professor of history at Berry College, where she teaches courses on Middle Eastern, Soviet, and world history. She is a cultural historian of the Middle East and Central Eurasia, whose current research focuses on gender, urbanization, and cultural experimentation in the Caucasus and Iran in the early 20th century.
Tigran Gregorian is an analyst and the head of the Regional Center for Democracy and Security in Yerevan, Armenia. He's also a columnist and a political commentator at civilnet.am. And Tigran previously worked at the Office of Armenia Security Council from 2020 to 2021.
Here's Kelsey Rice and Tigran Grigorian.
So I thought I'd start by just having both of you introduce yourselves. Tigran, why don't you start?
I work on the regional situation in the South Caucasus. On a more theoretical level, I'm interested in the democracy security nexus, and our organization is specialized in that. But on a daily basis, I follow the developments in the Armenia-Azerbaijan context, how negotiations are going, and all the other developments related to these issues. Of course, the interests and policies of other major powers in the region as well are of great interest to us.
Why have you devoted your working life to follow these events? What is it about your personal journey to this work?
Well, I think the major reason why I'm interested in this is because these events actually affect my life. I was born in Nagorno-Karabakh. I was raised in Nagorno-Karabakh. I worked there for many years. And when I moved to Yerevan in 2020, just probably 20 days before the Second Karabakh War, I started working for the Security Council of Armenia. The purpose was to help to alleviate the situation, to solve certain issues. But unfortunately, the developments since 2020 haven't been very positive.
Indeed, indeed. How about you, Kelsey? Why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Kelsey Rice. I'm a historian, particularly a cultural historian, as you said, of the late 19th, early 20th century. I've spent quite a bit of time in Baku, so my research is specifically in Azerbaijani cultural developments in the late 19th and early 20th century.
And what has drawn you to this type of work?
The simplest answer is I've graduated from college in the midst of the 2008 financial crisis. And one of the things I and a lot of my compatriots did was went to teach English abroad. And I made my way to Azerbaijan via first a critical language scholarship and then stayed there to teach and recognized an area where a lot of the interests I had about culture, where there's a lot of interesting work to be done that wasn't being done. And so I stayed and committed myself to learning more about that area.
Yeah, I see. You got the bug, huh? I totally understand. I have similar stories in terms of Russia. So just to start our conversation, I'd like to have each of you give us a brief history of the conflict over this region of Nagorno-Karabakh. Tigran, why don't you go ahead and start us off?
Yeah, so it's very difficult to present the entire history of the conflict in 5 minutes, so I won't be going too far. Probably we can start with the early 20th century when the first clashes between these ethnic groups started to happen. And the main tendency back then was whenever the empire was becoming weak, the Russian Empire, so the situation in the region, in the South Caucasus region, was becoming quite fragile. So there were inter-ethnic clashes in 1905 during the first Russian Revolution, not just in Nagorno-Karabakh, but in all the other places when Armenians and Azerbaijanis lived next to each other. But the active phase of the actual Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, you could say, started after the second Russian Revolution, after the Bolshevik Revolution, when Armenia and Azerbaijan declared their independence. And this territory, Karabakh or Nagorno-Karabakh, was a disputed territory throughout that period, starting from 1918 with the declaration of the two republics, with the Sovietization of the South Caucasus. Back then, the region was populated in majority by Armenians. More than 90% of the population was Armenians. So it was a very interesting interplay of local politics, of imperial politics. But this was like a frozen conflict from the very start, because the solution didn't satisfy either the Armenians or the Azerbaijanis. The Armenians were dissatisfied with the decision to put the entity, the Nagorno-Karabakh Autonomous Oblast, within the Soviet Azerbaijan. The decision was made in 1921 and the oblast was created in 1923. And for the Azerbaijanis, it was also not a positive solution because this entity was created, the Autonomous Oblast. So for them, this was an injustice as well. But this issue was re-emerging during the whole period of Soviet rule. Whenever the center was becoming weaker, or whenever there was a process of liberalization in the Soviet Union, like during the Khrushchev period, the Armenians living in Nagorno-Karabakh were raising this issue, because for them, this was not just an injustice, but of course, there were policies of discrimination coming from Baku as well. So when the perestroika period started with Gorbachev, the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh decided to publicly express their grievances and their dissatisfaction with the existing status quo. And the Karabakh movement, like the modern phase of the Karabakh movement, started in February 1988, when thousands of Armenians living in Nagorno-Karabakh expressed their will to be allocated to Soviet Armenia from Soviet Azerbaijan. So when the conflict started, it was initially an intrastate conflict. So it was a conflict within the Soviet Union. So it was about administrative borders. But of course, the reaction from Azerbaijan wasn't very positive. Anti-Armenian pogrom started in right after this decision by the parliament, local parliament in Nagorno-Karabakh. And after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, it turned into an actual interstate conflict. And it wasn't very black and white. So in the first period, Azerbaijan implemented policies of ethnic cleansing. What we have seen now in Nagorno-Karabakh, it was tried in the early 90s with the siege of Stepanakert in 1991, was a large-scale warfare against the civilian population. But starting from 1993, the Armenian side actually started winning the war, and it ended with a new status quo with the local Armenians controlling not just the Nagorno-Karabakh Autonomous Oblast, but also seven surrounding adjacent regions that were populated by Azerbaijanis before the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And since 1994, negotiations were going on, mediated by the OSCE Minsk group. But however, the fact is these negotiations didn't bear any fruit, and the conflict erupted again. The active phase of the conflict erupted again first in 2016, when Azerbaijan started a small-scale escalation in April 2016, and then the war of 2020, when Azerbaijan scored a decisive military victory, took over not just all the seven adjacent regions, but also a huge part of the Nagorno-Karabakh Autonomous Oblast itself. And after that, this policy of ethnic cleansing, the policy of depopulation of Nagorno-Karabakh from the Armenian population started. I think we could discuss it later.
Yeah, thank you for that comprehensive overview. Kelsey, there's something about this conflict that I don't fully understand. I get the claims of territory, right? You have a majority Armenian population in Nagorno-Karabakh. But is the conflict between Armenians and Azeris, what other aspects of it that make this region such a flare-up point?
There's a number of things that we can take all the way back to the late 19th century. Tigran mentioned in 1905 there were clashes. And so you have a long history of peaceful coexistence between Armenians and Azerbaijanis, and then flare-ups that are coming out of essentially resource competition and tensions over economic distribution. So one of the big drivers of the early 20th century conflicts was the rapid industrialization of Baku with the petroleum industry, where what you had were the Azerbaijanis were predominant in the countryside and more likely to be landowners. The Armenians were more likely to live in urban centers, and there was an influx of Armenians in the 19th century from the Ottoman Empire fleeing Ottoman persecution. And so Armenians were better positioned to benefit from urbanization and industrialization. So there were tensions over the distribution of economic benefits from that industrialization, where Azerbaijanis felt that they had been shut out and they suddenly found themselves a minority population in their major center of Baku. So you have these various factors. Oftentimes, this is represented as a Christian-Muslim conflict, or the Azerbaijanis and Armenians are blood enemies since time immemorial. And obviously, this is not true. You talk to anybody in Baku who is alive during the Soviet era, and they'll talk about their Armenian neighbors who they were very friendly with, who they remember. I'm guessing the same is true in Armenia, where there were large Azerbaijani populations that were deported in the late 80s. And actually, that's where a lot of this tension is coming, straight from Soviet nationalities policies, where this concept in the Soviet Socialist Republic of Armenia, Armenians live, and the Soviet Socialist Republic of Azerbaijan, Azerbaijanis live. The reality was there were a lot of Azerbaijanis in Armenia. There were a lot of Armenians in Azerbaijan. So in terms of Karabakh has been this kind of pressure point that both republics have been able to push, both in the Soviet era and now. For instance, the Armenian Soviet Socialist Republic requested the transfer of the Nagorno-Karabakh Autonomous Oblast numerous times in the Soviet era. And I think in 1945, the head of the Azerbaijani Communist Party, Mir Jafar Bagarov, responded with, "You can have Karabakh if we can have this majority Azerbaijani region of Armenia." And that spurred forced deportations of the Azerbaijani population there that happened in between 48 and 53, and then in the late 80s. And the Sumgayit pogroms in 88 were largely driven by Azerbaijanis from Armenia who had resettled in the Absheron Peninsula, right? So you have these constant population transfers that are happening that I think really spurs a lot of the antagonism.
Tigran, do you have anything to add to that, to the kind of what are the tensions that are contributing to this conflict?
I think there is a big academic debate on the 1988 pogroms on both sides. This narrative that there were pogroms in the late 1987 in the city of Kapan, pogrom of Azerbaijanis, was promoted by Thomas Duval. He first introduced this narrative in his book. But there is, I think, a wide academic consensus that there is no factual evidence supporting that claim. There was an investigation years ago, about 15 years ago, done by Armenian and Azerbaijani journalists. On Armenian side, I think it was Tatul Hakopian, and on the Azerbaijani side, I think Shahin Rezaev, if I'm not mistaken. So the idea was to find refugees from Kapan who actually fled Armenia before the Sumgayit pogroms, and they didn't manage to find anybody. So even Azerbaijani journalists didn't manage to find anybody fleeing Kapan before the Sumgayit pogroms. But this is an academic debate, and the problem is there is not much evidence supporting the claim that the Sumgayit pogrom was actually implemented by refugees coming from Armenia. But of course, in the aftermath of the pogrom, during the year, of course, there were displacement of Azerbaijanis from Armenia as well. And the actual Kapan displacement happened in November 1988.
To be clear, I'm not talking about a pogrom. I'm talking about Azerbaijanis who were deported, not violently, but who were deported from Armenia to Azerbaijan, which there were several hundred thousand. We do know that there were about 200,000 Azerbaijanis who were moved out of Armenia to Azerbaijan.
Yeah, but that happened after the Sumgayit pogrom.
Well, you've got the population between 48 and 53 who had transferred as well.
Yeah, you have that, but I don't think you could claim that there is a direct connection between this population shift that was implemented by the Central Soviet authorities. It wasn't implemented by the Armenian authorities, so it was a directive coming from Moscow. But I think it's very hard to find connection between these deportations, before these population shifts that happened in the 1940s and 1950s, and with the actual outbreak of the Karabakh conflict. The claim of the Azerbaijani side is that there was this incident that happened in Gapan in late 1987, and these people actually were so angry that they started the Sumgayit pogrom. But as I was saying, there is no actual evidence supporting that claim.
It's clear to me, it seems, and here I have to claim a novice on this issue, that it seems that at least in the rhetoric around this conflict, we have dueling nationalisms. And one of the things that interests me about the flare-up of this conflict during perestroika is this is also a time where, as you pointed out, Tigran, the center, Moscow, is weakening, and you get a revitalization that had been simmering for a while and aided, as Kelsey rightly put, by Soviet nationality policy, of a desire for monoethnic states of these republics. Kelsey, can you speak to the issue of nationalism in this period and how nationalist memory politics plays into the tension of the conflict, a tension I see right now in this conversation?
Sure. So with Soviet nationalities policies, you have this creation of an entire kind of intellectual class whose job is to explain the national history of each new Soviet Socialist Republic. And those histories have continued to be repeated into the present day. And so what you often have is a prescription to some sort of primordial nationalism for the Soviet Socialist Republic concerned, and you have to go through the past of that population, find their national heroes, find a legendary romantic bandit and turn him into an early communist, and that sort of thing. So what you get is in regions where you have a long, complicated, multi-ethnic history with plenty of archaeological and cultural evidence of that long, complicated, multi-ethnic history is a competition to prove those more primordial roots, when the reality is who was here first is never a particularly productive argument about who has the present claim to a territory. But this is where you see a lot of the, in both Azerbaijan and Armenia, there's a lot of academic energy placed in archaeology and certain histories of trying to create a historical narrative that can excise the other, when in reality, both of these histories exist together and often in conversation with each other and oftentimes contributing to each other's mutual cultural developments.
Right, right. Tigran, in line with this, as you stated in the introduction, you were born, raised in Nagorno-Karabakh. What role does this region and the conflict play in Armenian national identity?
Yes, I think it plays a huge role, and especially since the independence. You should understand that the actual Armenian independence was founded on the Karabakh movement. So the republic, the modern-day Republic of Armenia, came out of the Karabakh movement. So the leaders of the Karabakh movement became the first elite, ruling elite of the Republic of Armenia. Not just the president and his ruling part, but also the opposition. All of them were coming from the Karabakh movement. And throughout the 30 years, the Karabakh issue played a pivotal role in the domestic political discourse in Armenia, in the issues of identity. I'll give you several examples. In the last 30 years, there were several instances when there was change of power, or there was like an attempt to come to power using the Karabakh conflict. And the Karabakh conflict played a huge role in all these domestic discussions. What's interesting now that after the loss of Nagorno-Karabakh, now there are very active discussions in Armenia trying to reevaluate the history. The current ruling elite, which is keen to sign a peace agreement with Azerbaijan, and which is in a kind of a losing position in these negotiations, and at times is basically forced to accept certain exceptions, is now trying to reevaluate or reinvent the history of the last 30 years. And there are very active and interesting discussions and debates in Armenia about issues of identity, about issues related to the history. This is like a separate, very interesting topic. I don't think we should go into much detail, but these are the processes that are going on in Armenia. And these processes are closely related with the loss of Nagorno-Karabakh and with the ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh.
Kelsey, what about from the Azeri side? Because I get the Armenian claims, right? We were a majority, et cetera, but what is the Azeri claim? And what, again, similar to the Armenian side, what role does it play in, say, national identity, if at all?
Sure. So Baku is indisputably the cultural center for Azerbaijan now and became so in the late 19th century. But historically, Baku is a fairly small town, Caspian port town. The Baku Khanate was not one of the more prominent Khanates in the late 18th, early 19th century. So Garabakh and specifically Shusha play an important role in Azerbaijani cultural history. A lot of great poets and musicians came from Shusha, notably Khorshid Banu Natavan, the daughter of the last Khan of Garabakh, is one of the great poets in Azerbaijani. The composer Uzair Hajibeyov, the singer Jabar Garyagdoglu. So there's all of these figures who came out of Shusha. So Shusha city especially plays an important role in the cultural nationalism of Azerbaijan. And in terms of how the contemporary conflict works, I think we always say the Garabakh conflict, but Garabakh is shorthand for Azerbaijanis because in reality, it's not Garabakh alone. It's the seven other districts that were historically majority Azerbaijani and Kurdish. I think the Kurds get forgotten in this a lot, but there was a large Kurdish population in some of these districts as well, who were forced out. You know, there's about 750,000 Azerbaijanis who are internally displaced, who were ethnically cleansed from their homelands and who want to return. So you meet a lot of people who they talk about Garabakh, and then, but the thing they talk about most is Agdam, which is not Garabakh. It's one of the adjoining districts, or Lachin. And so for Azerbaijanis, independence was defined by this war in which 20% of what was internationally recognized as Azerbaijani territory became occupied. And so it plays a huge role in Azerbaijani identity too. And I think it will be really interesting to see what Azerbaijani nationalism looks like with this conflict having, now Azerbaijan is on the, has the upper hand in the conflict quite definitively. And that has not been the case until 2020. So things are certainly changing. So Garabakh certainly has historically been majority Armenian, but I think Shusha plays a really important role for Azerbaijanis. And then also the history of the Garabakh Khanate, which was a Muslim-ruled Khanate, although majority Armenian. And so I think there's a lot of historical memory around that Khanate as well.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that taking from what both of you have saying, there's lots of room for both victims and perpetrators across the sides here. And my first question is, this conflict has, before getting into the experiences of the people who've had to live through this, this conflict had been simmering for so long with various periodic flare-ups throughout the last century or so. Why did Azerbaijan, Kelsey, take a decisive action late last year to dismantle Armenian control of this region?
Well, if you'll allow me, I'll go back to 2021 and sure, then to 2023.
So fair enough.
It's been pretty clear for a while now that Azerbaijan was moving towards a military solution after 30 years of the Minsk group really accomplishing almost nothing. If you look at the weapons purchases that Azerbaijan was making from Israel prior to 2020, it seemed pretty clear that they were looking for an alternative solution to a peaceful diplomatic one. And I think it was strategic in 2020. It happened in the midst of a pandemic. The world wasn't paying attention and wasn't really in the mood to intervene. What is perceived by many to be a regional conflict, although I think some scholars have made a very compelling case that this, the world should care about this particular part of the world and the conflict that's happening. So that's 2020. And then, of course, Russia, the one major world power who really can step in these situations, negotiated a peace. And then Russia invaded Ukraine. And things did not go the way Russia planned for them to go in Ukraine. And so the decisive action in 23, I think, was once again strategic. Russia's peacekeepers were barely there. And Russia really didn't have the bandwidth to live up to its peacekeeping duties. And to, you know, Russia has long time been a military ally of Armenia and is proven to be not be a very good one. I think the Azerbaijani government recognized that they could bring a definitive end. And I think they learned in 2020 that the international community wouldn't intervene. In 2023, they acted when they recognized that the one major power who had historically intervened, Russia, probably wasn't going to.
Tigran, do you have anything to add into what is your view of why they decided to take this decisive action?
Yeah, sure. I will also start with the war of 2020. In 2020, Azerbaijan basically scored a decisive military victory, as I've already said, but it didn't achieve the political goals it wanted to achieve. So the Nagorno-Karabakh de facto republic continued to exist in some form, in a very curtailed form, but it existed. There was this line of contact, there were peacekeepers. So politically, they didn't achieve their goals. And their strategy was to achieve these political goals throughout the coming years. So they were very patient and very cautious in their interactions with all the international actors. And when the war in Ukraine started, when Russia invaded Ukraine, two major trends basically caused the ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh. The first trend, here I agree with Kelsey, is Russia's weakening role in the region. So Russia's diplomatic, military, political influence in the region was waning, and especially during the period when they had military losses in the Ukrainian front. But the second important trend, which is at times overlooked in the West, is the growing ties between Russia and Azerbaijan, Russia and Turkey, Russia's dependence on these two actors because of the Western imposed sanctions. We know what an important player is Turkey in Russia's attempts to actually circumvent the Western imposed sanctions. The trade turnover between the two countries has doubled since the 2020 invasion. Azerbaijan has a very important geostrategic and geoeconomic position. So Russia is trying to divert its economic ties towards the Asian markets. And Azerbaijan is part of this north-south transport corridor. And the cargo transportation through this north-south corridor has also doubled since the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. And you shouldn't also forget that 2 days before the invasion of Ukraine, Azerbaijan and Russia actually signed a declaration on allied cooperation, upgrading their relationship to the status, to the alliance status. And in the last period of the blockade of Nagorno-Karabakh, which preceded the ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh, Russia basically adopted all of the Azerbaijani talking points on Nagorno-Karabakh. If you look at the statements of Foreign Minister Lavrov, he basically repeated the statements coming from Baku. And there is absolutely no doubt that this operation in September 2023 was basically greenlighted by Russia, or at least Russia turned a blind eye on this operation. One of the things actually supporting this claim is the fact that the Azerbaijani officials have become much more complimentary about the Russian peacekeeping mission in Azerbaijan, in Nagorno-Karabakh, since the ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh. So there is no population, there is a peacekeeping mission there, a Russian peacekeeping mission. And the Azerbaijani officials like Hikmet Hajiyev are saying, you know, they are a force of good and they will stay until 2025 and they will probably stay even after 2025.
Here's a question from the Q&A, point of clarification, and I'll ask you this, Kelsey, before we move on to other issues. This person is asking, please differentiate between Nagorno-Karabakh and Karabakh. Both of them were invaded by Armenia with the help of Russia. Karabakh, this person writes, is much bigger and inhabited by more than 600,000 Azerbaijanis. You mentioned these two different regions, Kelsey. Can you explain the difference between them?
So Nagorno-Karabakh, it's this Russian-Azerbaijani mishmash of mountainous Karabakh, and it is the specific administrative district that was created, the autonomous oblast that was created, and was created pretty deliberately to kind of draw, if you look at the border, what's the logic of that border? It was to be drawn around the Armenian population there in the negotiations of how to turn it into an autonomous oblast, versus if you look at kind of the historical mountainous region where the Khanate inhabited, we couldn't clearly define those boundaries, but in terms of like, if you're referring, and historically it was very common prior to Azerbaijan being defined as a nation that people would refer to regional, like a lot of people in Baku said they lived in Shirvan, coming from the Shirvan Shahs, like that historical region. So Karabakh versus Nagorno-Karabakh. Yeah, Karabakh is, I would say, a more fluid concept versus, it never had like administrative borders, but it, in terms of a cultural region, it's going to look differently and include more of the kind of Turkish pastoralists who lived outside of Nagorno-Karabakh, the autonomous oblast.
So you had this dramatic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh in September 2023. And of course, you have, from our conversation so far, there have been other types of cleansings of populations. Tigran, can you talk about the experiences of people who've had to, I mean, it was a dramatic, really quick few days, it seemed, over 100,000 people just picked up and were pushed out. What was the experience of these people in this horrible journey?
Yeah, before talking about the actual ethnic cleansing, it's important to discuss the nine-month blockade that was imposed by Azerbaijan on the people living in Nagorno-Karabakh. So they started this blockade by using some fake eco-activists controlled by government, and it has been proven by independent journalists that these were government agents. After testing the red lines of the international community and the major actors in the region, they moved on with actually installing a state checkpoint on the Lachin corridor and basically from that point blocking all the humanitarian cargo transportation to the region. So starting from spring 2023, Nagorno-Karabakh became absolutely cut off from the outside world. So the Russian peacekeepers were capable of delivering some goods from themselves. They were trying to sell some stuff with overpriced stuff, but it wasn't enough. And an actual starvation actually started in summer 2023. So this was a tactic directed on the civilian population to induce them to leave the territory. President Aliyev during this blockade was very clear about his intentions. He was saying, the road is open. Whoever wants to leave can leave. And these policies preceded the blockade, actually. There were instances when the Azerbaijani forces were attacking Armenian villages or going around these villages with loudspeakers saying, this is the territory of Azerbaijan, you need to leave. And after the nine-month blockade, the military operation happened. It lasted for 24 hours. And of course, the balance of power on the ground was not comparable. Like, forces were mismatched, and it was clear from the very start that the local forces there do not stand any chance of actually resisting this attack. So during the first day, there were a lot of internally displaced people as well, thousands of people fleeing the Azerbaijani army in the regions that got occupied very swiftly during this attack. And when the road, the Lachin corridor, was finally open, everybody was convinced that it is no longer safe to stay there. With that, this state collapse happened in Nagorno-Karabakh because state officials are first of all human beings. They have their own families. They took care of their own families. And a state of chaos started. And that's why a lot of people starting moving towards the direction of the Lachin corridor. Actually, it has been documented that 64 people died during this torturous trip to Armenia. A lot of people died during an explosion that happened in these days because there was lack of fuel because of the blockade, and there was this huge depot where there was some fuel. People went there to get fuel, and then an explosion happened, and about 200 people died there, and they suffered a lot during these few days. But fortunately, when they arrived in Armenia, both the society and the government did its best to help and to solve the immediate concerns, the immediate needs of these populations. But there are still a lot of problems, and there are still a lot of issues related to the refugee population, to the rights of these people, to the collective rights of these people, to the midterm and the long-term integration of these people in the society. So it was a very horrible experience for all the people involved. From my personal experience, I could tell you that all of my friends and relatives who suffered the blockade and the ethnic cleansing, they have a long-term problem, psychological problem. All of them have insomnia. Some of their eating habits have actually changed. a lot of my friends can't just eat. They just eat once a day and that's it. And that's the effect, that's the consequence of the nine-month blockade and starvation that was imposed by the Aliyev regime on Nagorno-Karabakh.
Kelsey, do you know, is the Azeri government transferring settlers to settle the region? Because the impression I get from watching this unfold in the media is that the population is just gone. And so are they starting to repopulate it with Azeri settlers?
Yes, they're building homes. I think Ogdam in particular is going to be a focus of rebuilding, but they've started building homes in Zangilan. I know they put an airport in Zangilan. I don't know who's using it. I'm guessing it might end up having a military purpose, but they are rebuilding homes and the intention is to move because a lot of the internally displaced persons in Azerbaijan have been living in Berda, which is a city fairly close to the formerly occupied districts, and in camps. A lot of people were never resettled. And so there's going to be return. It's never going to be the same level of population it was, I think, prior to the war, because just demographically, since Azerbaijani independence, a huge number of Azerbaijanis from all over the country just live in Baku now. But yes, they are, I think they are working towards repopulating and rebuilding the districts. How quickly that's going to go, unclear, but they are definitely, there's some very nice looking new houses that have been going up.
Yeah. I mean, Tigran, you talked a little bit about how these people who have been displaced and are now refugees in Armenia, how they're faring. Can you speak a little bit more about what other people are experiencing? Where are they living? Is the government providing housing? I mean, these people have also been dispossessed of their property as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Government in the first period provided some basic shelter. And I think this is one of the differences between the approach of the Armenian government and the Azerbaijani government in the 90s. The Armenian government could have instrumentalized these people, putting them in refugee camps, but there was a political decision not to do that because the human needs were put first. And in the first period of the exodus, there were some temporary shelters like gyms or school buildings and stuff like that. But with time, the majority of people have managed to settle all around Armenia. There are underpopulated regions in Armenia, and there are like free houses that could be used for the refugees. The majority of people live in Yerevan, and it's natural because the level of life, the comfort is much better in the capital than in all the other regions. But one of the major problems is actually the rent price. It has gone absolutely crazy. Like if you compare it to the period after the 2020 war, it's very, very different. You could actually compare the housing prices and rent prices in Armenia with certain European countries.
And is that also I know this is for Tbilisi, for example. Is it because of Russians who've also left because of the war?
Yeah. So there was this first wave of Russian immigrants coming that affected the housing prices and the rent prices. And with the exodus of the Karabakh Armenia population, the housing prices have doubled, basically. The government is supporting this population, giving them some universal income, universal benefits, so they can afford these rent prices. But it's not enough, of course. And lots of people are actually struggling. You know, in the first period, a lot of people were staying at their relatives' places, but you cannot stay even at a relative's place indefinitely. Yeah, so now that's why I'm talking about the midterm and long-term challenges we are facing. The whole population has an employment issue. So that's one of the things that the Armenian government should be able to address. And of course, the permanent housing issues, affordable housing issues, should be another priority. But there are so many challenges and so many problems related to this issue, starting with psychological problems. A lot of people are even not considering going to a therapist. Also, it's a vital need for this kind of population. So a lot of problems. I don't think that I could describe all of them. Our organization will actually be working this year on kind of addressing these challenges and trying to help both the international actors and the Armenian government to come up with a comprehensive strategy that could give long-term solutions to these problems.
Kelsey, here's another question from my friend John Burgess, who actually works just right down the street from my house. Nice to see you here, John. Is either side instrumentalizing religious identity to justify their particular positions in the conflict? Does religion play a role in this, Kelsey?
The Aliyev regime is pretty stridently secular, and so they don't tend to use appeal to Islam. In fact, I would say the government tends to crack down on overly vocal Muslim religious identity in Azerbaijan. So no, I think I see a lot more ethnic identity being instrumentalized in nationalism than religion. I can't speak as much to the Armenian side, although I think Christian identity is more part of Armenian nationalism than Azerbaijan's Islamic identity is for Azerbaijan.
Tigran, does religion play a role?
Well, you know, historically, this conflict was never about religion. If we talk about 1980s, 1990s, it was a territorial conflict. But recently, I agree that the Aliyev regime is kind of wary of the religious activity within the country, but it's also obvious that they have been using the religious factor in their foreign policy. Like, they have been raising this issue in this organization, Islamic Cooperation Organization. They have been trying to show Armenia as this country who has been desecrated Islamic sites of worship without providing any evidence to that. They have been trying to actually spoil the relations of Armenia and the Islamic world using this narrative that this was an anti-Islamic movement, that, you know, the Karabakh movement was against Muslims and it wasn't like an ethno-territorial conflict. When it comes to Armenia, I think initially when the conflict started, both republics were part of the Soviet Union. So there wasn't much space for religion back then. So these were two atheist republics. Of course, with time, this religious component became notable. There are very important religious sites in Nagorno-Karabakh, Armenia religious sites. One of the first Armenian schools was actually opened in one of the monasteries in Nagorno-Karabakh. And these stories are part of the narrative, of the Armenian narrative, that, you know, and they tend to emphasize the prolonged historic presence of the Armenian population there. But that's it. Overall, the official line has always been very cautious with these issues because Iran is another important actor in this region, and Armenia and Iran have very good relations, that have always had good relations, especially in the early 90s when Armenia's borders were blocked from both sides, from Turkey and Azerbaijan, and there was a civil war in Georgia. Iran was the only gateway to the outside world. So Armenia never could afford to have any anti-Islamic or Christian narratives in the official talking points about the conflict.
Mm-hmm. Wow. This is, I've done a lot of these events, and I don't think I've had more people post questions and comments than before. Let me try to get to some of these other questions because they're quite interesting. A couple of people are mentioning, Kelsey, the issue with Azerbaijani displaced people and having to relocate them and the problem of landmines, right?
Yeah, I noticed that in the chat as well. And that's a very salient point.
Yes, we should also remember this is happening in the shadow of wars that have occurred in the last 30 years. Can you speak to this, Kelsey, this issue of landmines and the leftovers of the military conflict?
Yeah, so the majority of the displaced Azerbaijanis are from the seven adjoining districts that were depopulated. There are some exceptions, especially in Lake Lachin, but for the most part, they were not repopulated with Armenians. They were kept as a buffer, you know, military boundary. And so there's landmines there. And also just complete, right? Again, I keep returning to Ogdam because it is the biggest city that this happened to, but Ogdam is a ghost town. It's completely gone. Well, there's ruins. So it's a tall order to rebuild some of these places. But then also these territories were a buffer between Azerbaijan and the more like Armenian populated part of Nagorno-Karabakh. And so what do you do in a buffer zone? You put landmines.
A couple of people are also mentioning the role of other powers, right? Tigran, you've talked about Russia. You just brought up Iran, which I want Kelsey to address. But for you, Tigran, first, can you speak more about the influence of other powers in the region, Russia, Iran, Turkey, and even what role, if any, Europe has played? Maybe since you've already talked about Russia, you can maybe talk about the other ones based on your knowledge.
Basically, Turkish role is very straightforward. It supports Azerbaijan in all its policies. Before the 2020 war, the whole Armenia-Turkey normalization process hinged on the Karabakh normalization process. So the Turkish preconditions for normalization were concessions to Azerbaijan, signing of some sort of an agreement with Azerbaijan. A lot of people saw that after the 2020 war, when all this issue disappeared, Turkey would be more willing to actually engage in good faith with Armenia in the process of normalization. And there is a political will in the leadership in Armenia to start and to finish this normalization process. However, we have a very interesting situation here where the junior partner in the tandem controls basically the policies of the senior partner in the region. And Turkey's policies vis-a-vis Armenia or towards the conflict are purely based on Azerbaijani perceptions about the conflict. And that's not helping the normalization process between Armenia and Turkey. Turkey unilaterally supported Azerbaijan in the 2020 war. Turkish drones were used there. Turkish army officers, special forces were taking part in the Azerbaijani offensive in 2020. So it's a very straightforward role. We have discussed the role of Russia. Of course, it's much more complex, but I think I could move to the Western actors. So before the 2020 war, there was this period that lasted for about 10 years when the West, and namely the United States and France, that were the other two co-chairs in the Minsk group, basically outsourced the conflict to Russia. So the thinking was that Russia has much more leverage and influence on the parties, and the Russian leading mediation role would lead to an actual negotiated solution. Of course, that didn't play out really well. And then the presidency happened with the American isolationists and the U.S. basically withdrawing from the region. During the Trump presidency, it was the first period when the United States appointed a co-chair to the OSCE Minsk group who didn't have an ambassadorial rank. So it was a sign of a show of priority towards the region. The situation actually started to change since the outbreak of the war in Ukraine, because before the war, the Biden administration didn't really have a policy towards the South Caucasus. But when the war started in Ukraine, the U.S. and the EU actually stepped in. They started to play a deeper and a more serious role as facilitators. That's how they like to call themselves. They don't like the word mediator. So they started facilitating the peace process in the absence of Russia. Prior to that, Russia used to be the main mediator, the sole mediator. So they engaged in this process starting from spring 2022. And they didn't have much success because Aliyev basically played all of them, received all the concessions from the Armenian government on the Western platforms it wanted. And now Aliyev has basically sidelined the Western mediation and moved the process towards a bilateral form. When it comes to Iran, Iran historically had quite a balanced position towards the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. It always recognized Azerbaijan's territorial integrity, and it even congratulated Azerbaijan after the victory in the 2020 war, but it was like a passive support. Iran never really helped Azerbaijan in achieving certain goals. But when it comes to the sovereign territory of Armenia that has been under attack since 2021 by Azerbaijan, and parts of Armenian sovereign territories, the territory has been occupied by Azerbaijan, Iran's position is very clear here. Iran is saying they are against any change of borders in the South Caucasus. They are against this concept of the Zangezur corridor that has been promoted by the Aliyev regime. So they are trying to balance this Azerbaijani-Turkish push to get these maximalist concessions from Armenia. And the Russia's role is much more complicated, of course. I don't know whether we have time to talk about it.
Kelsey, what role does the fact that Azerbaijan is a main supplier of oil and natural gas, particularly since Europe, after the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, Europe is trying to move away from relying on Russian oil and gas resources. How does the resource extraction play, if any, in this conflict and the various positions of foreign powers?
Azerbaijan's increasingly, I guess, beneficial geopolitical position owes to a few things. fossil fuels being a big part of it, right? As Europe tries to disengage from dependence on Russian gas, Azerbaijan offers an alternative of both gas and oil. So there's a natural gas pipeline that goes through Georgia and into Turkey. And then there's also an oil pipeline that does the same, bypassing Russia, also pointedly bypassing Armenia, into Europe. Now, as Azerbaijan increases its exports of natural gas to Europe, it is purchasing natural gas from Russia. And so Russia is able to bypass some of the sanctions by selling its natural gas to Azerbaijan as Azerbaijan increases its exports of natural gas. So I would say this positions Azerbaijan quite well to improve its relations with Russia and also to improve its relations with the European Union.
Anything to add on the resource question, Tigran?
Well, yeah, I essentially agree with Kelsey's points. Azerbaijan has been actually using these resources to balance its relationship with the West and with Russia. There was a scandal when the president of the European Commission, the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, arrived in Baku amid these Azerbaijani aggressions against Armenia and stated that Azerbaijan is a reliable partner without talking about any human rights problems within the countries or the problems within foreign policy. So it definitely plays a role, but I wouldn't actually overestimate its actual effect on the foreign policies of the major actors, because the role of Azerbaijani gas is actually overestimated. They have an agreement up until 2027, but there is a consensus among all the experts, energy experts, that Azerbaijan is not capable of actually delivering the promised amount of gas because they don't have so much resources. So it plays a role, but we shouldn't overestimate that role.
Well, one of the things that I've been surprised by, and really considering the amount of attention the Ukraine war has gotten in the American press, let's say, and also the European press, I was expecting a lot more attention, international attention, when Azerbaijan cleansed out Nagorno-Karabakh. But there wasn't. The reaction has actually been quite muted. I mean, Kelsey, a little while ago, in our conversation, you mentioned some people have made very good arguments as to why we should care, right? Why we should care about what's going on in this region. Why should we care?
I'll start with geopolitically before I move to the more human level. We just talked about Azerbaijan as a source of natural resources. What we haven't talked about yet is Azerbaijan's role in a kind of broader security context, in that Azerbaijan's relationship with the United States as a strategic partner significantly evolved with the war on terror. And Tigran was just talking about the quite good relations between Iran and Armenia. And a lot of people who don't know much about the area would think, well, wouldn't Iran be better geopolitical friends with fellow Shia majority nation Azerbaijan, when in fact they have an incredibly tense relationship, right? Right south of the Republic of Azerbaijan is Iranian Azerbaijan. Iranian Azerbaijanis are the largest minority in Iran and have a long history of separatism. And so having an independent Azerbaijan that is not a repressive theocracy creates security and stability concerns for Iran, and Iran and Azerbaijan have a very tense relationship. Meanwhile, Azerbaijan has a fairly positive working relationship with Israel and that big old border with Iran. And so it's a small neighborhood, but it's a crowded neighborhood, and it's one with a lot of pretty contentious shared borders that play into larger regional and global interests. And what we're really seeing also is a more and more assertive and globally focused Turkey, right, coming in. Because for years, if you were writing as a political scientist about the South Caucasus, you talked about Russia, and as you didn't really, Turkey wasn't a huge factor into the relationships until much more recently. So there's a lot going on geopolitically in the region. And also, you know, there's a serious human impact here. And one of the reasons I will say I think that people stop paying attention so quickly is because the situation in Israel changed very quickly. And people have, at least in the United States, a limited attention span for international news, I will say. And very quickly, the crisis in Gaza completely dominated the airwaves and people looked away. But this is a place where you have hundreds of thousands of people who want to live in their homelands. And the situation is such that people have been prevented from living there. And for a long time, it was on one side that there were a lot of people who were shut out of their homeland. And now there's been another ethnic cleansing. And now there's a large portion of Armenians who are, I think, in a pretty desperate situation. And the international community isn't really paying that close of attention. And so while we would all love a solution where everybody could live in their ancestral homeland, the current impossibility of that is something that needs to be looked at. This is demonstrative of other conflicts that can occur in the world. And there's been a lot of suffering for over 30 years around this.
Yeah. Yeah. Tigran, same question to you. Why should we care?
First of all, about geopolitics, I think Azerbaijan's role was important after 9/11. But this importance and significance has decreased since the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. From a strategic point of view, now Azerbaijan, I don't think it has much strategic importance to the United States. And that's the consensus, I think, in D.C. policymaking centers, especially after September 2022, when Azerbaijan attacked Armenia, the sovereign territory of Armenia, becoming a source of regional instability and automatically enhancing the role of Russia. When it comes to the relations of the West with Azerbaijan, we actually see that Azerbaijan is the driving force behind this format called 3+3, which is an attempt by regional authoritarian powers like Iran, Turkey, and Russia to minimize and neutralize the Western influence in the South Caucasus. So this idea was first brought up by President Aliyev himself. And regarding Azerbaijan-Iran relations, with all the difficulties we have discussed, they still are very important part of Russia's efforts to actually revitalize their economy. The North-South transport corridor we were talking about, this is a very important project for Russia. And Russia has actually invested $1.5 billion to rebuild this route. The growing relationship between Russia and Azerbaijan is another sign. Azerbaijan has just been kicked out of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. So it is one of the three countries that have been kicked off. The other two ones are Russia and Belarus too. So the portrayal of Azerbaijan as some kind of pro-Western bulwark in the region, I don't think it's accurate. When it comes to suffering, I think the most important impact of the ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh is the valuation of all this talk about democracy and human rights. When you try to portray the ongoing conflicts in the world, like the war in Ukraine, as a war of democracy against autocracy, and then you tolerate an actual ethnic cleansing of a territory by an authoritarian state that has been recognized by Freedom House as worst of the worst. So according to the Freedom House, Azerbaijan is in the top most authoritarian countries in the world. And when it comes to suffering, I do understand the suffering of the Azerbaijani refugees, but the first war wasn't black and white. There were tens of thousands of Armenian refugees in the first war as well. As I've said during my previous answers, before the 1993, when the Armenian forces started taking over these territories, tens of thousands of Armenians were actually depopulated, were expelled from their homelands. We talk about the Operation Koltsov, the ring operation that was supported by the Soviet Union. So I think it's not good to explain the ongoing ethnic cleansing by the bad things that happened in the past. That doesn't lead to somewhere where we can have a better world to live in.
That was Kelsey Rice and Tigran Grigoryan.
Kelsey Rice is an assistant professor of history at Berea College, where she teaches courses on Middle Eastern, Soviet, and world history. She is a cultural historian of the Middle East and Central Eurasia, whose current research focuses on gender, urbanization, and cultural experimentation in the Caucasus and Iran in the early 20th century.
And Tigran Grigoryan is an analyst and the head of the Regional Center for Democracy and Security in Yerevan, Armenia. He's also a columnist and a political commentator at civilnet.am. And Tigran previously worked at the Office of Armenia Security Council from 2020 to 2021. All right. Well, thank you for that introduction there, Rusana. And I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
And this episode was edited and mixed by Daniel Cooper at Podcuts Editing. If you have any audio work that needs to be done, it certainly shouldn't be a hassle. And that's why we partner with Podcuts Editing and Daniel to do our work to make the show sound good. If you have any audio work that needs to be done, contact Daniel at podcutsediting.com and he will give you your first edit free of charge. And the Eurasian Knots is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh and listeners like you. Once again, show us the love and become a patron. Support this show. Let us know how much you value it. We can always use some extra money. And I guess that's it. So until next time, bye.
Bye. А потом ее чтрезим, чтоб не убежал.